This is Daryl Banks, co-creator of Green Lantern Kyle Rayner, and you're listening to Spoiler Country.
Hey, hey, people of Earth, it's time to enter the Spoilerverse via our secret portal at the exclusive Arctic Club in beautiful downtown Seattle. With our hosts, John and Kenrick and Jeff. Welcome to Spoiler Country.
Hey, if you're listening to our show for the first time and you're on one of the social medias that we're on, like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, any of those kinds of things, you should always check us out on spoilerverse.com. But if you want to keep up with our latest episodes, you should bring out your smartphone, get into your favorite podcatcher, find Spoiler Country, and hit subscribe. Then you'll get all our new stuff.
And if you want to reach out to us, you can do that in two ways. You can call us, leave us a voicemail at 707-656-2080. Again, 707-656-2080. Or you can shoot us an email at spoilercountry@gmail.com.
Citizens of the Republic of Spoilerverse, welcome back to Spoiler Country. I'm Kenneth Regan. That is Mr. Horsley. And today on the show, well, it's Daryl Banks, isn't it?
It is. Daryl Banks, co-creator of Kyle Rayner, the best Green Lantern out there, at least for my time, because that's the one I grew up
the
with.
The best Green Lantern.
An amazing artist. Jeff got to sit down with him and talk to him. Jeff is also a big Green Lantern fan, a big Kyle Rayner fan.
Yeah.
And they got to ask about lots of questions about, you know, his character and his creation, as well as, you know, Daryl's entire career, not just, you know, Kyle Rayner, but, you know, because Daryl's done more than just one character. He's done a lot of stuff in the industry.
Yeah.
And this was a fun interview. Jeff and Daryl had a good time.
That's cool. You know what's cool about the Green Lantern? I think this is one of the coolest things about the Green Lantern, is that they can make a new Green Lantern almost any time they want.
Right.
You know, and have a whole new character with new problems, new things, but still have the same concept of power sets and what they're supposed to do. Like, half of the character is already done.
Right. You have that, and that's how you have characters like, you know, Hal Jordan and Kyle Rayner and John Stewart and Guy Gardner and, you know, the new ones, Jessica Cruz and the new one right before her that I cannot remember the name of, Simon Baz, I think it is. And there's all these, so Green Lanterns, they have the same, like I said, power set, but
yeah,
they're completely different characters because of who they are.
Yeah, well, awesome. And their mindset and the way they are as a person can dictate how well their power set actually is.
Yeah.
Like, my favorite one is John Stewart, but I've said that a million times, so.
Yeah. I love John. I used to hate John Stewart. I love John Stewart now. Actually, my least favorite one is Hal Jordan, but still.
That's my least favorite one. Just because he's such a...
high five.
Yeah. Well, he's... Dude, Hal Jordan is such a... he's a typical freaking superhero. Like, I don't know. It's like he's just this white male dude. And it has nothing to do with him being a white male, but some of it does, where he's kind of like Buck Rogers. And
yeah.
You know what I mean? That whole thing. It's just like, it's the same... There's nothing original about Hal Jordan.
I mean, there might have been back in the 60s when he was created.
I don't think there was even then. It was
just a snapshot of the time.
Yeah. But he was a typical, I don't know. He's like a James Bond knockoff to me in some ways.
We're going off on a tangent about Hal Jordan here, man. We should probably get and listen to Daryl and Jeff in their own words.
Oh, fine. Let's do this. No, it'll be good.
Hello, listeners. Today on Spoiler Country, we're talking to the fantastic artist, Daryl Banks. How are you, Mr. Banks?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing quite well. How are you handling the new reality of COVID?
It's kind of rough, but we're making it, and we're gonna get this thing beat like anything else that's in our way. You know, we're making changes, keeping people safe, etc.
Are you being impacted on it personally, or because as an artist, are you kind of sheltered away from a lot of what's happening?
Well, the main thing is seeing conventions canceled, and that impacts me a great deal. especially Heroes will be this weekend and Charlotte, North Carolina. And yeah, wow. That's every time I see that red marker on the calendar crossing it out, it's like, you know, looking at a gravestone, like, oh, because I love that show. But
so you're out of are you out of North Carolina?
No, I'm in Columbus, Ohio.
Oh, okay, very nice. So that'll be a bit of a trip for you. Something that you look forward to?
Oh, love it. Well, it's always a road trip with me and a really good friend of mine, Yuko Smith, who's also an artist locally. And, you know, we do that show. Been doing it for about, 5 years, I think.
It must be rough to, because I know a lot of artists' income comes from conventions, commissions, sales. What kind of stuff are you doing to, like, offset that huge loss?
Well, fortunately, I haven't suffered a loss, thank God. It's just more like, I think, I'm also a commercial artist, so, you know, it's just more like dialing that up and taking on more commissions and that sort of thing. So it's balancing pretty well, but still, you know, conventions isn't just income. I just love doing it. It's the travel and meeting fans and the whole nine yards, and just not being able to do that, you know, this is the toughest part. I mean, thankfully, I'm able to keep working without interruption, but, you know, so many Americans, well, not just Americans, but people across the world are having a tough time, and, you know, my heart goes out to them.
So do you still have any conventions left on the schedule, or is it totally blanked out now?
It's some of my later shows. It's a wait and see type of thing. You know, I've only done one show this year. That was in February before everything hit. And a lot of the mid-year shows were canceled. The only show that I'm confirmed for that hasn't canceled so far, to my knowledge, is the Cincinnati Comic Expo.
Is there any chance you're going to next year head to anyone's? I'm from Rhode Island, so if you could head to one on the Northeast, that'd be fantastic for me.
I did the Rhode Island Comic Con for the first time last year. Absolutely loved it. I forgot I was in Patriots country. And I mean, deep into it, I thought, wow. But the show was great. It was huge. Very well organized. I loved it. If they would have me back, I'd be there in a second.
Yeah, I must. That was the 1 year that where you went up to the Northeast, and I actually had messaged you a few times on, I think it was Twitter. I was like, "When are you coming to Rhode Island Comic Con? When are you coming to the Northeast?" I remember you responding that you're, you know, hoping to go one day, and then when you finally signed up to go to Rhode Island Comic Con, I had already paid my tickets for Trificon. So and being you know, somewhat broke, I could only afford to go one convention or the other. I had already told, you know, my wife and paid the tickets to go to Trificon. So I totally missed out on Rhode Island Comic Con. So I missed out on you. So you desperately need to come back to Rhode Island because I need autographs. I told you before we record that I'm a huge Green Lantern fan. I literally have quite literally every single Green Lantern issue, backup issue, annual, spinoff since the 1960 first issue from the 1960 Silver Age comic.
Oh, really?
So yeah, I'm like I said, I'm insanely huge Green Lantern fan. I have many comic books of yours from your run on with Kyle Rayner up on my wall in top loaders, and I wanted to autograph them all from you for a long time.
Okay. Well, I'm. It was looking like I was going to come back this year, but they canceled it. So, but I would say I'm very, very confident that, you know, I would make my return to that show very soon. So you made the right call by going to Terrificon, because, you know, I'll be back in Rhode Island at some point. I'm very confident in that.
I truly hope so. Like I said, your art is really phenomenal. And like I said, well, and I have a lot of questions built up for that. So we'll get to in just a moment. One question I definitely wanted to ask you, it seems like the new reality of the comic book industry, for at least the near future, is virtual conventions. Are you attached to any of those?
No, I kind of did an informal one. There's a show I do every year in Dayton, Ohio called the Gem City Con, and we kind of did a partial virtual show for that. And I don't know if the network was real busy, but everything, the sound went cutting in and out. It was after the point, like, why are we even doing this? But, you know. we were doing video, you know, and sound, so I could see everybody, but it was, you know, cutting in and out as far as the sound. But
that seems to defeat the purpose of the convention completely.
Well, I like the fact that people understand that, you know, conventions are they have layers to it. Like I said, it's not just the income I miss. It's just the camaraderie. It's like being on a home planet where, you know, everybody's a mutant like I am. You
know? That's awesome.
So yeah, I think that's how we had the advent of the virtual convention. We missed that connection. It's probably deeper than we realized, especially when we couldn't do it.
Well, I will say, as someone who does frequent conventions. I mean, like I said, usually I go to one big one a year and then there's a few small ones. I'm also doing some writing on a very indie level. So I do once I get tables locally. And I will say it from someone who gets autographs, sometimes I buy them online. Sometimes I buy them. I'll get at conventions when I can. The ones that you get where you go bring your comic books to the artist like yourself and you watch them sign your comic book always has far more value than when you buy them separately. I mean, it's considerable.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, I'm not just an artist. I'm also a fan. I consider myself a bigger fan than I am as an artist because, you know, I grew up with such a connection to it. It meant so much to me on so many different levels. And to be able to see how people appreciate that, it just means a lot to me. It's very motivating. It's just funny. I think about the people that I get excited to see just like everybody else. I remember there was a show, where was I? The Motor City Con had Dave Gibbons there. And, you know, I kind of cut the line to see him because his line was almost around the building. I thought, this is going to be my one shot. I don't think he comes to the United States that often. So fortunately, one of his handlers at the time was somebody I know. So they were understanding. And everyone in line was too. I apologize, but like, I got to take a selfie and say hi, you know. So I was just as excited he means as much to me as he does everybody else. Like we're all on the same level when it comes to someone the magnitude of a Dave Gibbons, you know?
Yeah. Well, he's a huge legend. And it's kind of, I think it's really cool when an artist, when you're a professional like yourself, talks about being as excited to meet other artists as we are to meet someone like you, because you know, say I can't help. Part of me always feels like once you become, you know, you're a big in the business, a big professional, that part it gets lost a little bit, but it's kind of cool to know that it doesn't.
Well, because for me, it just runs too deep to never get excited about meeting certain individuals. I mean, the thing is, who I'm excited to meet might be different than you would expect. I mean, I've met Stan Lee once and it was great. And it was, you know, the magnitude was there, but I get excited to meet maybe a particular artist that was, you know, a favorite of mine at a particular level of development as I was training, you know, that sort of thing. So I might be more excited to meet, let's say, Dave Cockrum, who used to draw X-Men, than I was Stan Lee. Now, not never forgetting the magnitude of a Stan Lee, but as far as to me personally, as an artist, there was a little bit more of a giddiness there. You know, that's, I don't know if that makes any sense, but it's more.
It does.
I'm like that. I think with a lot of convention guests, you know, because as a matter of fact, speaking of Dave Cockrum, when I met him, he had no one in line. He was just sitting at a table by himself. I'm thinking, this guy gave us Colossus, Storm, Nightcrawler. I can go on. And he had no one at his table. Oh, so wow. I bought a Storm print from him and we, you know, chatted for a second and that was about it. I couldn't talk long because I get starstruck real easy. So I thought, I literally thought of what I was going to say and kept it short and left. So
now which autograph of yours is it Dave Cockrum who's your favorite autograph that you have? There's one that's more special.
No, that was just an example. I mean, as far as favorite, that's hard to say, but that's tough to say, but I just use that one because that's someone I was excited to see, but apparently few people were, at least at that particular show, which baffles me. I'm like, this is Mr. X-Men himself amongst other things. I'm like, I literally was saying, do you guys not know who that is? You know,
I mean, do you find that fans have extremely short term memories when it comes to artists and writers?
It just depends. I think sometimes it's popularity and it's, you know, and granted, you know, at the time, you know, when I met him, you know, even though he's passed away now, rest in peace, but maybe younger fans didn't connect the name with who that was. For example, I was, you know, I'm a big fan of Japanese superheroes like Ultraman. So I was at a show in Lexington, Kentucky, and I got to meet the original Ultraman, the actor who was in the suit and all that.
Again,
you know, he didn't have a line. And I'm thinking, God, I wish I could speak fluent Japanese. I know a few things, but it's like, you know, like, do you guys not know who this is? And it's like, that just keeps happening, you know?
Yeah. So,
now, granted, you know, a chance to meet someone that everyone's heard of, like I've met Jim Lee several times, you know. Yeah, that's great. Of course, everybody knows him, you know, but with me, it might be a little bit different. I think everybody has that same specialty personality, writer, or artist, what have you, that they really want to meet that might mean something different to each individual.
Well, I'll say if I was going to say my own, I had the fortune of back a few years ago, I was the public relations specialist for a convention called BoroughCon in New York. And I was able to help get Ron Mars to appear and got his autograph when I showed up. And to me, that was my favorite one. Because once again, my favorite character of all time is Kyle Rayner. And I being able to get Ron Mars there as well was a big deal for me, especially as a writer, you know. Yeah. Ron Mars with the beard. So that was one of my, I would say, like, golden autographs, you know.
Oh, good.
And he's a great guy, and we'll talk about him later as well, because I definitely want to. I got a lot of questions about your time working on Green Lantern, especially with Kyle Rayner. I did want to ask, so getting into comic books, was it the X-Men that was your first break into the comic book world as a fan, or?
Oh, that dates back so far, it's even fuzzy for me. It's like way back in the 1800s when I was a kid. Spider-Man was what really hooked me on superheroes. Now, granted, I was into comics even before that.
Yeah,
you know, it was whatever relatives would hand me. I mean, it might be Archie, it might be Casper the Friendly Ghost or whatever. But I remember we had moved, and my friends in my new neighborhood were more into superheroes, and it was kind of like, oh, I like this way better. And so mainly Marvel. I mean, some DC, but you know, I pretty much in my formative years, I was more of a Marvel fan, and particularly Spider-Man for almost obvious reasons. You know, he was the youngest solo superhero that I could think of, and great cast of characters, great rogues gallery, and so on.
It's kind of interesting listening to professionals talk about what they read as a kid and what they ended up becoming known for. Because interestingly enough, like I said, you said you got into it as a Marvel fan, but you kind of reach your fame in DC.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked a little bit with Jerry Ordway, I think it was last week, and he was a fan of Marvel as well, ended up getting hit famous from DC as well. So was it weird to be, you know, or maybe not even weird, but was there added pressure working in the company that you maybe weren't as familiar with, or would have been more pressure working on the characters you remember reading as a kid?
Well, see, the thing is, I had respect for DC. I was just more into Marvel as far as a fan. But whenever I would show my portfolio to Marvel and DC, DC always seemed the most interested, and they gave me the most feedback on what I specifically should be practicing and getting better at. Of course, I was getting rejected by both of them, so it didn't matter at first. But DC, you know, they would always end with, okay, do this, this, and this. Here's my card. Marvel was like, yeah, not quite there yet, kid. Send me on my way. You know what I mean?
Oh, so wow, okay.
I remember I was in Chicago once. I had just showed my portfolio, I think, to quite a few different companies. And I had a DC business card in my hand. I said, something says whenever this starts to come together, it's going to be with DC. I have a feeling. Not that I was afraid of it, but it was more like,
yeah.
But I wanted to draw Avengers. That was the goal. But yeah, but I think it worked out very well.
Well, obviously, I mean, like I said, your run on Green Lantern, from when I do my research, and I looked into it, and it said that you ended up being the penciler for almost 70 issues of Green Lantern, and that, especially in today's world, is absolutely unheard of to have not only an artist on a comic book for that long, but the artist team on a comic book for that long. I mean, that is nowadays, you just would never see that ever.
It was just a different era. I mean, this was the 90s. Of course, I came in more mid 90s when things were cooling down. I wish I'd got in where the crazy money was there. I missed that. But with the 90s, there were so many, you know, trying different things. You know, whatever is the new popular thing. There was a lot of experimentation. I mean, we had, you know, Dick Grayson was Batman for a moment, and Superman was dead, and et cetera. So with Green Lantern, they were open for the change for that because the book wasn't doing that well. I mean, you know, granted, they were supposedly all these enraged Hal Jordan fans, but they weren't there to prop the sales up when Hal Jordan really needed them, which is kind of funny, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Green Lantern has gotten, I mean, considering for a short time, Green Lantern was immensely popular in the early 2000s for a while as well. He's been canceled a lot of times. I mean, in the 40s, he got canceled in the late 60s for a little while. He got canceled, you know, in the 80s. He's been canceled quite a few times.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, there was this misconception when Ron and I were on Green Lantern that we didn't like Hal Jordan, and that was not the truth. What we thought was, what can we do to make people realize this character should be an A-lister? He really should. And it's kind of like, you know, we made that happen. You know, we made him more powerful than he ever was. The original goal was to bring it all full circle, return the core and everything else. But it got so popular with the actual hires up in the company, certain things would happen that was taken out of our hands, because there's a definite hierarchy when it comes to editorial. And, you know, when a higher, you know, when higher authority says, oh, we're going to take this character to do this, that, and the other, you got to go along with it. You know, it's like you've got varsity and junior varsity type of thing going on.
Yeah.
I mean, go ahead.
No. Well, I was going to say, before you became a comic book person, was Green Lantern one of the titles you were reading and you had a connection to, was Green Lantern not a thing prior to your getting on the project for yourself?
I was only into Green Lantern sporadically, and it was mainly for the art, with few exceptions. It was, you know, I remember in college, I would get the back issues that the Denny O'Neill, Neil Adams stuff.
Yeah.
But that was more to study Neil than anything else. Of course, obviously the Denny O'Neill stories were award winning.
Yeah.
I remember picking up some of the Joe Staton stuff because, I don't know, his almost animated feel was very attractive. I mean, not was, he's still around. But it just, there's just something about it that I always thought was very interesting, with his variety of character designs and his ability to draw. And let's see. Oh, Pat Broderick. That was another. Broderick run that was when Hal Jordan was graying at the temples. It was like, wow, you know, heroes aren't allowed to do that. You know, this is interesting. But I was never like, oh, I'm a big Green Lantern fan in general. Actually, just the opposite. I always thought this is a character with so much potential. But, you know, when I thought of him at his core, but no pun intended, he was making boxing gloves and vacuum sweepers. And I thought, you know, I actually started a series of sketchbooks of, you know, if I was drawing Green Lantern, he would be making stuff like this. But that was never a goal. It was just more like just something I did just to practice. Knowing that I would fall back and be able to put it to practical application.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, your Green Lantern, like I said, I have some more specific questions I'm going to hit before we get quite to Kyle Rayner. But one of the things that I love about Kyle Rayner, there's so many things I love about Kyle Rayner. He's, like I said, he is my favorite all-time Green Lantern. And I started buying comic books around 1989, and Green Lantern from 1989, but it was Kyle Rayner that I truly loved as a character. You guys did such a phenomenal job, you and Ron Mars. With not only did I like the personality, the idea that I think – what was interesting about Kyle Rayner that you developed was, first, it was weird as a fan to know more about the character than the character knew about himself on some level. I thought that was fun, because, like, you know, say, because you literally got to watch him learn about what it was to be a Green Lantern, and as a fan for years, you're like, almost like shout out the pages, like, no, this is who they are, this is what this is all about. You know, I want to help you out the best I can. You know, and the other thing that was fantastic about Kyle Rayner was his constructs, because he was an artist. And they were way more intricate than Hal Jordan ever was. They were far more fascinating than Hal Jordan ever was, and definitely more imaginative. And I assume, I don't know for a fact, that comes from you.
That's a very wise assumption, but actually that was not my idea.
Oh, wow.
To make Kyle Rayner an artist was actually, that was Ron's idea. And of course I went along with it. I thought that was fantastic, but no, I remember just the creation of Kyle Rayner. That went through so many phases as far as what he was going to be like, but then, you know, Ron really fleshed it out, and then with the icing on the cake and he's going to be an artist, I'm thinking, fantastic. So when I draw inside of his apartment, all I'm essentially going to do is draw where I live. I don't feel like deciding where he lived. He lived in New York, but the inside of his apartment looks suspiciously like a series of apartments in Columbus, Ohio.
So when we're reading a Green Lantern, we're gonna be like, oh, so that's where Darryl Banks looks, what his house looks like, or his room.
that's where I used to live, but yeah. Especially my art studio area. Of course, Kyle's was a lot cleaner than mine, but I think mine was a little bit more cluttered than his, because I didn't want to draw that much deep.
Well, you know what they say about clutter? The more intelligent the person, the more they tend to have clutter.
Well, then I must be a genius then, because...
Yeah, exactly. That's the same thing I tell my wife, too, you know? Now, when Ron Mars is... I assume when you're, the comic books are they script form or plot form?
Script. For some reason, you know, the other artists that I know, they like working from a plot. I've done that, but I really prefer a script because I just kind of want to get to like what, basically asking a writer, what do you see? You know, I feel like when I'm doing a commission, when someone said, yeah, you know, I'd like a commission, they don't just say draw something. It's like, well, what do you want? So when I have a script, I feel like it gives me an idea of, you know, what do you want to accomplish? What do we want to say with these characters, et cetera, as opposed to, because I feel like working from a plot, it's almost like I'm writing it too.
Yeah,
I don't want to write it. I just want to apply my wheelhouse. You know?
Now, when you're getting the script, when you got the script from Ron Mars, did he just write construct and let you come up with what you want, or did he tell you, I see this, I see that?
He would give suggestions. He'd have some ideas in mind. One reason I think I've worked with Ron so long is that he's a writer, but he thinks very visually. And I think that has a lot to do with, he knows a lot of big name artists. You know, he's friends with, you know, with Jim Starlin, and he was good friends with Bernie Wrights and that sort of thing. So I think even though he's a writer, he thinks very visually. So in the scripts, he'll have suggestions and he'll always go, or if you can think of something that works better here based on what we're trying to do with that particular scene. He would give some suggestions.
Now, did your freedom on what you did increase the longer you worked with him? Because like I said, 70, you're for that almost entire 70 issue run, you were with Mars. It seemed like, though, I think a little bit you worked with Winnick, I think a little, if memory serves.
Yeah. Towards the
end. But I assume from issue 50 to, I think it was almost 100, you were with Ron. Now, over that time, did you find that because you worked so long, did you get like a shorthand? Did he start giving you more freedoms of what you wanted to do with the comic book? Like more say about the stories or whatnot?
I got a lot more freedom with character creation. For example, I actually had more to do with the creation of Fatality than I did with Kyle. I mean, with Fatality, they just said, all right, Spawn has Angela. We want to give Kyle Rayner an Angela. Go.
Oh, wow, okay.
And then, of course, when I pitched my idea, he kind of fleshed it out like, okay, well, let's do this, 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 and add to that. But I had a lot of input into it. Or we knew we wanted to have a son of Darkseid. And so what do we want to do with it? So I designed it. And I said, well, Darkseid always looked like a statue, you know, like, or like an idol. I said, like a graven image. I said, well, let's call him Graven, but with a Y. And it's like, oh, okay, yeah, let's go with that. So we
That's cool.
took that and then fleshed it out.
I don't think I ever thought of Fatality like Angela. Well, now that you're saying it, I can see the connection completely. But one thing I liked about Fatality, in many ways, Fatality was one of the best new rogue gallery for Green Lantern. And it seemed like for a long time before the Ron Mars took over with that Green Lantern that they were forgetting a lot of the rogues gallery. And Fatality seemed to be one of the best of his new group. And
that's what we wanted. I thought, you know, when they trusted me to come up with some ideas, I said, well, to me, a hero is only as good as his rogues gallery. And I thought, you know, let's give him some interesting characters. Let's give him unique characters. The first thing I thought is, well, you know, Angela is obviously a popular character for Spawn. I said, well, Fatality, I don't want to feel too obvious, even though I gave her Green Lantern earrings, just like Angela has like Spawn symbol earrings, and they both have a huge spear. But I wanted to kind of like, you know, let the similarity end there. So I wanted to make sure that we, you know, it wasn't just a gimmick or just felt too derivative, but that she had a life of her own.
And I think she was a phenomenal character. And I thought it was interesting. I don't know if you still read Green Lantern at all or had read Green Lantern, that eventually they did make her a hero towards the end. I think they put her as a Star Sapphire, I think, at some
That's
point.
That's correct. That's correct.
But yeah, I mean, did they talk to you about doing that with the character at all? Or, you know, like when did you find out they were doing that with your character?
I think I found out about it in a comic shop and going, hey, that's Fatality. She's a Star Sapphire now. So no, I had no idea. I was very happy to hear that because, you know, once again, just about everything we did, especially early on, this was the 90s. Everything was here today, gone today. I figured, you know, Kyle Rayner had maybe a year in him. A year, maybe 2 years. And that's it. He would be a trivia question about crazy things that happened in the 90s. And it's like 2020 and he's still around. You know, that's shocking to me, you know?
And I must say, like I said, he was always my favorite. And I find it shameful on DC that they don't use Kyle Rayner more now. I feel like at some point the bringing back of Hal Jordan and Rebirth gave Kyle Rayner almost nowhere to go because you couldn't have Kyle Rayner be what he was. I mean, he was the Torchbearer. He was eventually Ion, and you know, eventually a White Lantern. His all, you know, the best aspects of all Green Lanterns. You couldn't have him be that and still have Hal Jordan be your dominant Green Lantern.
I always thought, you know, I wasn't following it very closely, but I thought it was very interesting. I'd peek in and see, like, oh, look at Hal's constructs now. They sure look awful detailed. They elaborate.
Right. I agree.
I'm not saying that I started that, but, you know, I just kind of doing a before and after, like, that's interesting. Hal seemed like drawn a little younger and creating more intricate ring creations, like,
I'm telling you, you should hashtag Jordan ripped off Kyle Rayner. But it does seem that way. And once again, going back to what you had with Fatality, I think she was a wonderful Rogues Gallery. I think it was her motivation. She kind of has that classic Rogues Gallery motivation where it's directly connected to the hero. They're intertwined. Her motivation is understandable on some level. As far as, you know, to her, you know, from her perspective, the idea of every villain is still on some level a good guy. And I think it was a very rich character. The appearance of the character was also worked really well. And I think it was a tremendous character that you created or helped create.
Well, thanks. The thing is, I gave her a lot of thought since it gave me so much leeway. I didn't want my shot at, you know, creating something to fall flat. So especially starting out, she was supposed to be like Angelo. I thought, well, I want to make her black for one basic reason. I couldn't think of how many black female supervillains there were anywhere. So I can't think of any. Like if I maybe spend 20 minutes, I might think of someone, but just the sheer fact that I couldn't think of any of that. So that was going to separate her from Angela. And also I wanted her connection to what I call John Stewart's greatest failures. What, you know, his arrogance caused the death of the planet Zanshi back in Cosmic Odyssey.
Yeah.
That big event. So that, you know, that connection would give her, you know, like you said, motivation to hate Green Lanterns. And so, you know, Ron and editorial, they liked it. So we, you know, we fleshed it out and the rest is history. She even has an action figure.
Is it the one with Star Sapphire, or does she have one that's original, just Fatality?
Fatality. Yeah. With the spear and everything.
I've never been able to find that one. What the hell is it?
Oh, that's a long time ago. That came out back in, not too long after her first few appearances, maybe around the time of her second appearance, possibly. But it was by DC Direct.
I think you gave me some homework to do, sir. I'll go find Fatality. Mm-hmm. But that's incredible. I think one of the most interesting things as well of your time on Green Lantern, once again, Green Lantern is my thing. Like, I have so much of my bedroom is comic books of your Green Lantern run and my toy, you know, action figure line or whatever in my front room of figures from it, is that the thing that you started Green Lantern at issue 50, if I'm remembering correctly, with the end of the Emerald Twilight saga.
As far as interiors, now I started doing covers with 48, but okay. As far as inside, yeah, 50 was my first full issue.
So it's weird to have a change in pencilers, I would think, at the end of a major storyline to suddenly switch an artist. Like, how did that happen?
Oh, there were so many things going on. The thing is, even during my run, I didn't do all the issues because I was way too slow. We had great guys like Paul Pelletier and Jeff Johnson helping me out with issues. I hate to call them fill-ins because their work was so good. You think of a fill-in, you think of something just slapped together, like hardly. I'm like, hey guys, don't look too good. They won't want me to come back. But yeah, that's how I was able to have such a long run. That I had, you know, we were a team, you know. I shudder to call them backups, but you know, they were kind of thought artistically, they were hardly second best. They were amazing. Still are.
Well, the covers from 48, 49, 50 are fantastic. Once again, they're on my wall, right near my bed. And I think one of the most interesting covers is issue 50 because it was glow in the dark. Did they tell you that's what it was going to be when you were doing it?
I think I found out just before they sent me copies of it. It's kind of like, now keep in mind, I wasn't shocked because this was the 90s. You had glow in the dark, you had hollow foil, you had poly bagged with trading cards. So, you know, glow in the dark, that wasn't shocking like it would be today. Because, I mean, you had all types of gimmicks going on in the 90s around that time, you know, across the industry.
And I would definitely would say it's that some of the, I mean, the covers, you have the one where Jordan has all the rings and looking totally insane. You have the one, you know, where he's reaching up in Coast City when it's all in ruins, and the one where Parallax is flying towards the reader. Those are so dynamic. You created some of the most dynamic covers, I think, of almost all Green Lanterns. That one's, they stick in my memory so, you know, so distinctly, even if they weren't on my wall. And thanks. And what inspired the making of those?
Like I said, having the desire and the goal to work at Marvel, everything I draw for or have drawn for DC, honestly, I had Marvel in mind. There used to be a book called How to Draw a Comic the Marvel Way.
I have it.
And okay, I got that as a Christmas gift when that book first came out in 1978. to me, the Marvel Way, I mean, obviously DC had great artists, but there was something about that Marvel approach that I always wanted to incorporate, but not really fully understanding what that was. So to me, dynamism was one thing that was definitely a part of it. You know, I think about the artists that were always inspirational to me, like Neil Adams or the Buscemas, you know, John and Sal Buscema, Herb Trimpe, et cetera, Jack Kirby, you know, just that larger than life, the powerful foreshortening and all that kind of stuff. So in my formative years, trying to incorporate that any way I could, you know. A matter of fact, there was a Green Lantern cover where the character of Alien Mongol was kind of like bear hugging Kyle, like kind of crushing him.
Yeah.
When I did that, I literally, I think in the prelims, I drew it as the controller and Iron Man. It's like, I thought, you know, I would love to do an Iron Man cover. You know, I love the controller, that huge, bulky character, about the same proportion to Mongol. And so you mentioned that Marvel influence. Like, yeah, I always refer to that to myself. Like, that's my Iron Man cover.
That's awesome. I was wondering, is the look of Major Force, is that you? I can't remember Major Force coming out before that issue came out.
No, he had existed, I think, even before I was with the company. I didn't design him. Just got had the pleasure of drawing the character.
well, definitely. Eventually, I do want to ask you a question about Major Force. I'm sure there's an issue that we're definitely going to talk about, the refrigerator issue. I know it has to come up at some point, or listeners would be annoyed if I didn't really bring it up. But sure. We'll get to that. We'll get at some point. But once again, it was a famous, very famous issue. The one thing I wanted to go back just a little bit on is on issue 50, you got to do two things in that issue that I thought was really incredible. You basically got to bring back Sinestro, who had not been seen since the last issue of the previous volume. I mean, the character had been gone for, what was that, 7-8 years almost, I would imagine, before you drew him again. Okay. What was that like?
I wasn't sure when his last appearance was. I remember we had a character, was it Sonar, in an issue. And I thought, I said, hey, Ron, is this character supposed to be dead? He said, when did he die? So I don't know. So neither do I. And chances are maybe the fans won't either. So we're going to use him. So with Sinestro, maybe, I don't know if he was dead or what have you, but it's kind of like, yeah, he fit into the story and no one complained. So it, editorial didn't either. So
yeah. So because his last appearance was issue, I think 225 or 224 of the previous series. And then he showed up, not didn't show up again to issue 50. And with a gap in between, obviously, from between series, that's a long time to be gone. And considering how popular Sinestro is now, you basically created or drew, was like the first one to draw the new modern Sinestro for, you know, this current generation, because because it was for so long, you know.
And it was very enjoyable. I mean, Sinestro is so much fun to draw. You know, just he's, you know, the antithesis of Hal Jordan in many ways, but then in many ways they're the same. And so I love the, especially when Kyle got to meet him. That was definitely a career highlight, because it's kind of like that was a whole nother dynamic of them facing off. And I want to say issue 100.
Oh, I do remember that issue. I have the cover, the Hal Jordan on the cover with Kyle Rayner together. I actually have a poster in my room with that issue on it, that cover with Hal Jordan and Kyle Rayner on it. And I believe that's the one, I think I might have had that autograph. Oh, I bought that one. I think that was an autograph with you on it, with Banks on it. And I was saying that's just a phenomenal cover with those two characters together. And then, like I said, having adding Sinestro to that whole thing.
I should remember what issue that is. I think it was Saturday. I've got a comp copy of a hardcover Green Lantern 80 Years of the Emerald Knight. It's got a cover the front cover is by Jim Lee and the back cover is by yours truly.
Nice.
And it's I guess it's a pretty thick volume of like key issues of the Green Lantern history itself, from the original Martin Odell origin of Alan Scott. You know, you've got some classic Neil Adams. I got a couple stories that I did. We've got even some modern stories with looks like Jessica Cruz in here as well. So even though it's reprints, this is a really good volume, I think. I don't know if this has been on sale or they just got around to giving me a comp copy of it, but
I think it comes out in August because it's on my pull list. I buy everything Green Lantern, so that's on my pull list, and I think it's August.
Okay. When I opened the package, I thought this was the story I just worked on with the 80 page giant. I thought this feels like a lot more than 80 pages, but no, this is something else. I'm like, oh, okay.
So you did an 80 page giant as well with Ron. Do you know when that one's coming out?
Well, it was how many pages? It's an 80 page giant. Where you've got Mike Grell, you've got Ivan Reese or Rice. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Oh, you got it's quite a lineup. And so, Ron and I, we just did that. Our story is about 8 pages, and I did it all digital. That's the first time I've ever done complete digital story for DC. I've worked in that medium before with a graphic novel Ryan and I just recently did called Harkins Raiders. But as far as DC Green Lantern, that was a first. So I felt really confident that, you know, that it was going to come out really well. And really the surprise for me was when I got the version of my artwork when it was all in color. I don't know who did it. It was a studio called, I think it was called Hi-Fi or something like that. And it was everything I had hoped for. They over-delivered. I loved it. I'd like to find out who that studio is so I can thank them. Because there were little details I thought, that may get skipped over. And it's like, oh, no, they picked up on that. So, yeah.
So the 80-page giant is not going to get a print release, only digital?
No. It's going to get a print release. It's just the artwork that I did.
Okay, gotcha. Because once again, I definitely would be buying that one as well, especially once again, a new Daryl Banks from our story is definitely getting purchased. Was it a Hal Jordan or a Kyle Rayner story?
It was Kyle, yeah.
Oh, I'm definitely buying that one. Can't miss a Kyle Rayner at all.
If you check out our Twitter, we've got a couple preview pages up. No, this might have been a couple weeks ago, so you might have to dig back a little bit. But yeah, we've got some preview pages that we're allowed to show.
I'll definitely check that. And like I said, do you know when it's being print release?
I'm thinking next week because I've got a store signing at the end of this month on the 27th, and I'll be signing it. So I'm thinking, you know, it's got to be, you know, in retailers' hands next week, I would imagine.
Oh, okay. Well, like hopefully on my pull list, it just says everything Green Lantern. So hopefully he grabs it for me.
Okay.
So to make sure I grab it. I think I literally had the store owner just write that down. Anything Green Lantern. So I'm buying like Far Sector, anything with Green Lantern, anything. If he's in Justice League, I buy that as well. Anything with Green Lantern on it, or especially with the title, it's purchased. So it better be on it. Like I bought the kids DC graphic novel just because it's a Green Lantern. I need it for my collection. So I bought that as well. So I should have had that in my collection.
Fantastic. Well, the thing is this, they kind of made it difficult on collectors. It's got a bunch of variant covers. Unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to do one of them, but it would be difficult to decide who had the best variant cover, but I would even venture to say if it's possible to get multiple copies of it with some of those different covers, that would be worth having in a collection.
Oh, certainly. And I think, and which one you said you're doing on the 80th anniversary, it's the one with Jim Lee and you're on the back cover of that one.
No, the book that I was referring to, that has different covers. This one just has one cover, the hardcover reprint book.
Okay.
That has it's got Hal Jordan with the power battery, and in the background is a bunch of smaller reprint covers, like kind of giving you a hint of what's inside the book.
Okay, gotcha.
And kind of the same on the back. It's Hal when he had all the rings from what was this page one of issue 50.
Okay. That is so awesome. Well, you also created the look for Parallax, didn't you?
Yeah, gave him that name as well.
Oh, seriously? Well, that's very cool. Well, where did the name and the look come from? What inspired it?
Well, the look was Hal felt that wanting his desire to recreate Coast City, where you know his family lived and all, it was a noble cause. And I thought, well, does it get any more noble than a knight? So I knew I wanted to draw him in some sort of armor. Plus, I love drawing armor, so that was the note. And the name Parallax, originally DC had said, we're going to call him the Protector in the story, leave us alone. I thought, I campaigned. I said, we can't call him the Protector. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we own that name and that's it. You know, stop bringing it up. I was like, okay, but, you know. So I thought, you know, let me, but the I literally had to write out what, you know, how the word Parallax could relate to Hal Jordan, because it deals with the position of stars, or you could say, or Parallax is just point of view. And I thought, if nothing else, Hal Jordan has had a radical alteration to his point of view. And that's why I felt the name Parallax was appropriate for him. And it was one of those things like, well, okay. But it took a while. It took a while.
But it works. Parallax is so much better than Protector. It would have, it not only does it define the character better, but when you also look at what Geoff Johns eventually did with the name Parallax, it would have been horrible to connect it over to like the Protector, the Yellow Protector.
Right. Right. I mean, you know? Even in the movie, I mean, that creature was called Parallax. I even thought like, hey, shouldn't I get a little money for that?
You should have. Speaking of that real quick, do you get creator credit for Fatality and Graven as well or no?
I wish I did. I feel that I should. I think I probably need to, you know, get something like that in writing, I guess. Now with Kyle, I do. But
oh wow, okay.
At one point, even if they made toys, I would either get the toys or they would, you know, they would compensate me and Ron and that sort of thing. So maybe that's something we got to look into.
I think so. I mean, if I'm not, do villains in comic books, do they get creative? I mean, cause it feels like they should. I mean, if you create a great villain, they do get creator by, I only ever see it when they have their own like titles connected to them.
Oh no. I don't know what it was, but just imagine Jim Starlin was well taken care of for Thanos, cause he's a little popular right now. So
yes, indeed.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just the stuff of urban legend about what that check must've liked. And I mean, it could be even a character that's not even that major. I think there was some character that had a cameo in Batman versus Superman or something like that. And an artist had said, oh, I designed that character. And, you know, they paid me for that. So, yeah, they don't have to have their own book. They just have to be used and, I guess, have some sort of contract in place to make sure they do the right thing by you. So,
Well,
one thing, DC is good with that. So I think, you know, if we have that discussion, I think we'll work something out.
Well, I definitely would say that we should bring back Fatality just for you to help you out. Because Fatality, once again, is a great character, but also it'd be nice to see created by Darryl Banks on there as well.
I think so. I think that she's a good character. I'm not really following what she's up to now as a, you know, as a Sapphire, part of the, you know, the Star Sapphires. But, you know, hopefully, you know, she's still, you know, well respected in whatever appearances she's making.
Now with Parallax, do you get credit for the name use, or is it the connection to the Hal Jordan character?
Well, right now it's just like the answer to a trivia question. They're not, you know, not really doing anything. I thought if that was the case, I'm like, well, you know, that name appeared in a major motion picture, or maybe not major motion picture, but, you know, I thought, hey, can we talk about this? You know?
Yeah. Now, before the interview, I was talking to some of the other guys from Spoiler Country, and they asked me a very specific question. It's not a question I would normally ask, but whatever. You saw the Green Lantern movie, you said, correct?
Yes.
And John from Spoiler Country, he compared the look of Parallax to a giant fart cloud, and he wanted to know how you felt about that's what they did with Parallax.
Well, let's just say that's a little bit different than how Ron and I approached the character. That was kind of more of a Geoff Johns thing, and I think I'm going to leave it at that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I must say, I know what Geoff Johns did. Obviously, he did it to redeem the Hal Jordan character. And when you knew that, do you think he should have been redeemed, or do you think they should have left him as is?
Ron and I had plans to redeem him anyway, a different way. But the thing is, what resonated with fans is that Hal made a mistake. And it's like by saying it was a creature that did it, it's like saying, you know, the devil made me do it. It's like it kind of dissolves him. It's like, I think people like the idea that, you know, you can get so mad and do something you regret, even though you had the best of intentions. But now, that's not to discredit what Geoff Johns did, because he really, first of all, I have to say, I was surprised that Geoff Johns really attached himself to Green Lantern the way he did, because this guy was a really big deal writer at Marvel. He was writing the Avengers and everything else. So I thought,
you know,
the post Kyle Rayner era on Green Lantern was attracting this huge talent pool. I mean, thinking you had Geoff Johns, you had Carlos Pacheco, who was drawing X-Men. This guy was the regular X-Men artist. Next thing you know, he's drawing Green Lantern. You know what I mean? It's kind of
yeah.
I mean, think about it.
I think what it was nice with Geoff Johns is that he did, because at that point too, Green Lantern had quieted down again, that it helped reestablish Green Lantern, created the emotional spectrum, which obviously is what's been Green Lantern's been clinging to, and maybe even overused for the last, you know, 10 years or so, or maybe probably longer than that. But what were, did you said you talked about it with Ron, what were your plans to redeem Hal Jordan with?
We never got to the point where we could really flesh it out, but that was just something we wanted to do. We wanted to bring it all full circle and restore the core, everything else. Ron likened it to leasing a car. You know, yeah. You can drive it, put miles on it, but you got to give it back. So that was the plan. But the thing is, it was, you know, Hal Jordan, Kyle Rayner, they performed at a much higher level than the company expected. But that's what happens when you let creative people, when you leave us alone and we could do great things. Think about it. We got Spider-Man because Stan Lee's editor said, Amazing Fantasy, that's not doing it well. You could do whatever you want.
Yeah.
So the end result is he and Steve Ditko created Spider-Man. It was this thing. If Amazing Fantasy was doing great, who knows how history would have changed.
Yeah. 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 Now, when you were creating Parallax, was there any talk of him showing up at Zero Hour as the main villain, or did that come out of kind of nowhere?
That was out of nowhere. I found out from a friend, a childhood friend, my best man at my wedding. He was coming over to my house. He said, "So, what do you think about Zero Hour?" And I'm thinking, "Yeah, I've obviously heard of it." When I first heard about the plans for it, it was the villain's name was Extant, the guy in the red armor who's And so he was like, what do you think about the villain of Zero Hour? I said, yeah, Extant, he might be pretty interested. No, the guy he works for. I'm thinking, he doesn't work for anyone. He's the main villain. No, he's not. I said, well, who is? He said, well, Parallax is. And because, we grew up together, he's messing with me. So I'm like, okay, what's really going on? I'm like, look. So I found out what everybody else did. I'm like, what? So the hires up had made that decision, to include him in things. Like I said, there's a hierarchy there. So they're like, yeah, we really like this Parallax guy. So, we're going to, raise the stocks a little bit by having him involved in Zero Hour the way he was.
Now, as being the guy who basically created him, did that feel, really good that he was involved like that? Or did it annoy you that, one, they did it without talking to you, or you didn't get to do it yourself?
No, I was like a kid on Christmas. That was like validation. It's kind of like I knew what we had done was great with it, and seeing, this is Parallax surrounded by the Justice League and Earth's heroes, and he's this major threat and all this kind of stuff. That's fantastic. The kid in me is going, I can't believe this is real. that was amazing. I still geek out over that.
Now, you also did, if memory serves, you did issue zero where Rayner first fights Parallax, correct?
Yes, yes.
Now, how was it with bringing those two characters together?
That was great because it really enabled, I think it told a story, not just hero, villain, because I honestly never approached Parallax like a villain. I thought of him more of as just a very frustrated person who was pushed too far, Have you ever seen that Michael Douglas movie, Falling Down?
I know of it. I have not actually seen it, though.
That was, part of the reason I made his Parallax hair spiky was kind of partially because of him. His character kind of had a similar haircut. If you ever see the movie, you'll go, hey, I thought that hair looked familiar.
That's cool.
It was one of those things where the main character, Michael Douglas's character, he wasn't evil. He was just pushed so far that he did things he wouldn't have had he not been pushed to that limit. And I thought, that could happen to the best of us. So that's really my take on Parallax and Ron's as well. We never really said this guy is DC's Magneto, kind of more like, he was his own character. He felt that what he was doing was justified. And in many ways it was. He was just going about it from a very extreme angle.
Well, I would say some of my favorite issues from Kyle Rayner's run did involve Parallax. I mean, Parallax View was a great series as well. I think having like the idealistic, younger, maybe even naive Kyle Rayner facing off against the far more experienced and definitely corrupted Hal Jordan, there was some great chemistry between those two characters.
I think so too. I really, you know, like I said, Ron's ability to flesh out characters in a, especially in a short period of time, really to this day, really amazes me. When I think about, and you probably have maybe a special segment you want to talk about Alex, but I just want to do a little sneak preview. She was not a character that's been around in the DC universe for years and years and years, but my editor told me that when she died, they got more letters about her death than Hal Jordan becoming Parallax.
Yeah.
It was weird.
Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, even now, I'm sure you've heard of, well, Gail Simone and her comments about it. I think it was a fridging. I think the truth calling it for a character. Right. And obviously there was some blowback from that. How did you handle that when that first kind of became like a thing or a reference, the idea of fridging the female characters?
People misconstrued. I think Ron got this label as being some kind of misogynist, like he hates women. It's like, even though he's married and has daughters, like that was the case. Alex was created to be to Kyle Rayner what Uncle Ben was to Peter Parker. I mean, that was literally the day one reason for her creation. She was, because we couldn't have Kyle Rayner have an uncle die, so like we'll make it a girlfriend. That will be, you know, that'll serve that similar purpose. So it was not like, you know, let's just kill women for the heck of it. Like, no, that wasn't it. It was more like she was Uncle Ben. But the funny thing is, you know, people reacted as if we killed off this major character that had been around for years. I don't think she had appeared, what, 3 or 4 times tops?
Yeah, I think that issue is issue 53 or 54. So issue 51 would be her first appearance. Yeah, 3 issues maybe. But because of Kyle Rayner, though, that interaction felt so real. I think the other thing that got people a little bit, other than like Uncle Ben, I mean, Uncle Ben basically died. I mean, I never read the original issue, but I imagine he died the very first appearance that he ever showed up in. When you and Ron introduced Alex to that comic book, you felt like she was going to be a permanent part of his life. You just felt the connection felt real. The storyline felt real. And you felt like, here's Alex going to be in the comic forever. So when it came out, I think I was in my late teens. It was shocking.
Well, I remember for me, when I was a kid, the death of Gwen Stacy was very unexpected. Or the first death of Elektra in the Frank Miller's Daredevil. I always wanted to be a part of a storyline where a character died and it had meaning and it wasn't just a gimmick. But with Alex, I think she was part of the original cast, and you would assume she would still be around. It's like, you know, surprise. But it wasn't done, you know, because of some sort of agenda against women. Is totally wrong, you know, such as it was.
Well, I mean, I totally agree with you on that. I mean, obviously, you kind of have to bring it up because once again, it was such a seminal issue in the industry. I mean, that is for a comic book that I don't know if you guys intentionally meant it to be as huge as that one issue turned out to be. It became very seminal. But yeah, so definitely had to ask you about that. But no, I totally get what you were saying. And I do wonder if partly because Kyle Rayner sometimes gets called the Spider-Man of DC sometimes. I don't know how you felt about that.
Well, it, kind of intentional. So, I mean, I can't do anything but say, yeah, that was Peter Parker was definitely a template. There's no way around it. I mean, he just was.
Yeah.
The one thing, the reason I think that the whole Alex thing is still a talking point even to this day is because the Comics Code Authority was still around back then. And so the page you saw in the printed comic was not how I drew it originally.
Okay.
The way I drew it originally was that she was dead and she was in the refrigerator, but the refrigerator door was open. And so, you know, you could see that all the shelves were smashed so that to accommodate the body. Cause I don't know about you, but you know, you can't fit a body in my fridge unless they're in pieces.
Exactly.
And I think that's true for most people's refrigerators. So the comics goes, oh, we can't show this, you know, this dead body. So you got to cover it up. So I had to make a patch of this, you know, the door, the way you saw it, like it's closed. But I thought, well, that's going to make it worse because I'm thinking, I've never seen a fridge that you could put a body in. So people are going to think it's going to have a, you know, a foot on one shelf, a hand on another, that sort of thing. And that's just making it worse. Well, guess what? That's exactly what people thought.
If they left it the way I drew it,
I don't think we'd be talking about it to this day. I just don't.
Well, that's how I thought. I literally thought that she got crammed in. Like, she literally got, like, smashed down and, like, stuffed in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, it is one of the more famous issues. I mean, that your Kyle Rayner, once again, like I said, he's my favorite character. And I think you guys hit so many right notes throughout that entire first 50 issues of his appearance. Like I said, you had the Alex issue, Mongo and fighting Mongo and losing, Parallax View. Then eventually you gave him a relation with Donald Troy, which I thought was a very clever thing for you guys to do as well. That was important. And I think Kyle Rayner. And I think the other thing that was interesting is that he was inherently just a good character, a good guy. I mean, even with adding the death of Alex, just gave him that little bit of not only motivation, but heroics that I think is needed in your characters.
I think having a character who goes through an emotional spectrum of things connects with people because, you know, we all go through things. And so being able to see our fiction reflect, or at least in some ways remind us of coping. For example, you know, growing up, you know, extreme introvert or whatever, comics was a coping mechanism for me. So people tell me, like, oh, you know, growing up on Kyle Rayner, it helped me deal with life. And I'm thinking, at first I'm like, well, that's crazy. I'm like, well, wait a minute, that was the effect that comics had for me. So it's just weird being on the receiving end of that. But
yeah. Well, and I think that one of the other things I thought is interesting, once again, I was saying earlier, the idea that you learned as he learned, but the other part I was thinking of as well is when he first shows up at the back end of issue 50 and Ganthet just gives him the ring and he's like, now you're a superhero. I'm thinking of, like, what explanation do you have for him to be a superhero the way and dedicated superhero without that level of tragedy? I wonder what the alternative might have been, him just wanted to be. I mean, he didn't have that extra push.
That's the question. What, you know, what if, and it looked like Kyle, based on his personality, he probably wouldn't have been a superhero.
But right.
Unfortunately, you know, he needed that motivation. I mean, we've certainly had imaginary stories of what if Uncle Ben hadn't died? What would, you know, Peter Parker, he was going to be a wrestler, you know?
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, the events played out the way they did, but on the positive side, we got a powerful hero out of it.
How did you come up with his look?
That's a good question. That was a lot of, see, Parallax, I only had maybe a couple rough ideas, and I had a strong idea what I wanted him to look like from the very beginning. Kyle, not so much. Remember, this was the 90s. Image was really huge. So some of the rejected Kyle Rayner designs, he looked like a seriously dated 90s character. Oh, it was awful. It's like, I mean, people think, oh, you know, I can't stand his look as it is. Well, oh, you should have seen what we didn't go with. that's pretty funny. I remember I had one costume I really liked. My editor goes, look at all this detail, this unnecessary detail. He said, if you had to draw 22 pages of this every month, you would hang yourself. It's a, just think about it. You want to keep this simple and to the point, and you will thank me later. And he was right. He was right. Kevin Dooley was right. Keep it basic and say a lot with less.
Now, once again, he has the big mask on, which is definitely is more like an armor mask. And obviously you walked away a little bit from the green on the Green Lantern, kind of highlighted more the black color in him, less the green. I know you said you thought of a knight for Parallax. What was your mental image of for Rayner as how you set up the design for that?
His final design is actually really a kind of a Frankensteining together of rejected ideas. Like, okay, we like the boots and gloves of this one. We like the bodysuit of this one. We like the symbol of this one. And we like the mask of that one, and kind of put those together. And that's what we got. Now, his mask, actually, I was inspired by a Marvel character that I grew up on called Sunfire. I always liked Sunfire's original look. Just something about his mask followed the contours of his nose, but not closely like a Batman. And don't ask me why that uniqueness, I just always stayed with me. I thought, that's different. I love it. If I design a costume, yeah, I want to be able to incorporate that, but I didn't want to make it too close. So I put some angles to it and obviously just made it just on the front, not covering his whole head. But that's why his mask looks so weird. I was trying to channel Sunfire in a way, but not make it look too obvious.
That's cool. And I mean, are you surprised that that look for Rayner lasted so long? Because even after they eventually put him back in the regular Green Lantern uniform, but over time they put him back in the Rayner look. Are you surprised that it lasted that long?
What really surprised me is when he, you know, his current look now looks very similar to his original look, but except the symbol's different. I remember I got a message from Ethan Van Sciver showing me the cover. And I thought, oh, this is a cool, you know, variant retro cover. He said, no, this isn't a retro cover. This is the look that Kyle's going to have. I'm thinking, you know, Ethan's one of the best costume designers out there. He could have made him, it was his book at the time. He could have made him look like anything he wanted.
Yeah.
And I was deeply honored that he, you know, he liked that classic look that much. So, I mean, even the recent action figure that came out, you know, has got that design. And so I think that's fantastic.
Well, like I said, I mean, for a lot of people like me, that look, I mean, even though I started off with the Hal Jordan look, that look just became so synonymous with the character and became so important. Because like I said, Kyle Rayner, to me, became, I mean, they call him the torchbearer, but as a reader, became what reignited the love of Green Lantern for us. Because he felt like over time that he loved, you know, doing it. He had, to me, the most original look for a lantern. I loved it. But I think the other one was the idea that you got to explore what it was to be a lantern with him. And that must have been, and he was the only lantern as well, which I thought was fantastic. Better than having the whole core for that time.
What we wanted to have was we wanted the reader to feel like what it would be like if they themselves were learning the powers. You know, it's like an introduction of the character and the overall, you know, mythology of the Green Lantern universe in general, and that people would grow with him. You know, he would gain in confidence. I mean, I remember when he joined the Titans, how great that, you know, that felt to see, even with other artists drawing him. I felt like I was drawing the Titans. I kept thinking maybe one day he could even make it to the Justice League. And then when that day came, I got to tell you, it was like Christmas. I'm like, the character that I co-created is right there with Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman. You know, it was unbelievable. It was, this guy from Columbus, Ohio could have input on this character that is now literally in the big leagues.
And that was a tremendous, I mean, Grant Morrison's run on JLA was phenomenal. That was such a iconic Justice League run too. And Rayner was a large part of it. Him and also his interactions with Wally West as the Flash were just great moments.
I think so.
The other thing we're just talking about is another thing that you did. You worked on the Spectre, Hal Jordan. Were you the one who created that look for him, or was that from a previous one?
That was whatever was going on in the Spectre. I got a chance to draw him, but no, I didn't have any.
Well, was it fun bringing him into Green Lantern? Because you did get a chance to have the Hal Jordan Spectre. Did you enjoy that?
That was kind of different. I mean, I wasn't really into it. I just never really saw. I mean, I got what they were trying to say with it, but it's kind of like, Not really into the idea of Hal being the Spectre. Not really.
Well, it was definitely short lived. I think the series, I think, only lasted 22 issues. I think it did. It didn't last long. I mean, if it lasted that long, I'm not really sure.
No, I like the Spectre as a concept and as a character. I just wasn't crazy that Hal Jordan was.
Yeah, it sounded like that was their first attempt to try to redeem him was through the Spectre. And I remember the series, without insulting anyone, if I remember the series correctly, because I bought those issues as well, because obviously it was Green Lantern connected, he just whined a lot. He whined for like 18 or 20 issues. And I didn't think that was Jordan.
One thing I did like the issue that I drew with Spectre Hal was that when he was able to reach into Carol Ferris's mind to kind of help her get over being Star Sapphire and the guilt that went along with it, like he helped her reach a level of healing.
Yeah.
And I like that. You know, that's my biggest takeaway of that issue.
Now, was it weird when you transitioned from working with Ron Mars to working with Winnick?
Yeah, I mean, Judd was, I mean, an accomplished award-winning writer as he is to this day. But we didn't have it was more like he wrote it, the script showed up, and I just had to draw it. He doesn't bounce ideas off of me, really.
Yeah,
but that was just his style. I mean, that's what how most writers work. But like I said, Ron was kind of a different animal. I really only worked with a couple writers in my career that really wanted my input. You know, and the thing is, they're not wrong to not seek it. I mean, because that's not part of the job description. But you know, Ron was really interested in some of the things I was thinking, and so he figured, if he really could get my emotional investment into what we're doing, I'll produce better artwork. And that equation tends to work very well 10 times out of 10.
And well, it was kind of interesting because you were the veteran on Kyle Rayner, and that when Winnick took over, Rayner was obviously far more your character than it was his. I would have thought that he would have been like, hey, this is, you know the character way better than I do at this moment. You are definitely the veteran on this character. You're the co-creator of this character. I figured he would have reached out to you and be like, hey, what do you think should be done?
Well, I mean, he was hired to bring, his take on the character. So he didn't do anything wrong with his approach. You get what I'm saying? It's more they wanted him to do his take on it. And so his approach, was complete. Judd was a consummate professional. I just think people were more used to my pairing with Ron. But, I mean, think about Judd Winnick. He went on to, didn't he do Under the Red Hood and all the?
Yes, he did.
So his resume speaks for itself. But I just felt like Green Lantern was probably not something that I think brought the best of his writing style. But that being said, it was just a different approach. But he wasn't wrong not to constantly consult with me the way Ron did, because that was, like I said, Judd was more, that's how it tends to be, done in the industry. But, Ron and I were cut from different cloths, So I think that's how we gelled together so well.
Well, I mean, there was definitely a tonal shift when Winnick took over. I mean, one thing I do love about the Green Lantern is that the scope is unbelievable. I mean, you can have the story set on Earth, and it works perfectly fine as a standard, fight the bad guy, bank robber, whatever. But then you also have the scope of the entire universe. And I think that's right. was one of the best things about his character. And if memory serves with Winnick, I think he drew it away from the scope. If memory serves, it's been a while since I've read those issues, though I've read the, I think you and Ron Mars did just, you guys just work perfect. You were one of those, there are certain teams that are just legendary. Like once again, Denny O'Neill, Neil Adams, Banks, Mars, so it's one of those teams that just felt perfect,
Well, that was, we certainly tried. I mean, the thing is, there were so many gimmicks in the 90s, but we never approached it like a gimmick. We essentially did comics that we ourselves would like to read. It's almost like if we were reading this book, what would we expect out of it? And that's kind of our approach to it.
Now, I was going to ask how it felt to be back with Ron Mars doing Green Lantern again, but you've been working with Ron Mars, I think, also on Ominous Press and a few other series. I mean, you guys have kept as team for a long time.
It's almost like it just keeps happening. It's to the point where it's like, hey, Ron, I swear I'm not following you around. They're approaching me to have me draw your stuff. So, yeah, it was. It's weird how that kept happening. I think the longest time we spent not working together was when he was at Top Cow. That had potential, but no, that we never worked together at all during his years there. But although when I think about it, I did a Laura Croft Tomb Raider story for Top Cow, but with a different writer. But no, it seems like with Green Lantern, I think people realize that we make a decent team. So who knows?
Maybe it's definitely,
we could do some more stuff.
Well, I mean, you're teaming up with. I mean, it's a special connection that you guys had teaming up. And I mean, I know you didn't do a Witch Way, but it must feel good as an artist and to know that you have a writer who constantly goes, I want Daryl Banks,
Well, I used to teach years ago. And one thing I used to tell my students is that, sometimes it's easy for up and coming artists to think it's all about how well you draw, paint, et cetera. With me, I would tell them I've gotten plenty of work, not because I was the best choice. I think I try to bring enough elements to the table that in totality that makes me a choice that writers want to work with. For example, I would tell my students, how well you draw is only about maybe 60% of your success rate. The rest is going to be 40% of intangibles. Like, are you going to do the work the way it's expected of you? Are you going to have a good attitude about it? Are you going to be professional? If there's a problem, are you going to communicate well? All those type of things, I think, add that little extra something that can be used to an artist's advantage who may not be the next Jim Lee or Alex Ross or somebody like that, which, I thought, well, make it up in other areas. And so I think that was why I was on the book so long, because it's not like my work was better than anything you were seeing out there. And it's not like it was definitely not the fastest. So but I brought other things to the table that it kept them interested.
Yeah, I mean, relationships are important. I mean, once again, I also have, like I said, I do the very small market indie comic books that I write, and obviously I got to hire artists. When you have an artist that, because you know, it can be tough sometimes working with anybody else. But when you work with an artist, especially when you build a relationship, you do have a desire to keep bringing them back. And that's business. That's a assured business for that individual that you created that relationship. So the next comic book I want to work on, I go, hey, I want to work with this guy again, this artist. And that's money in their pockets every time.
It's like, treating it professionally and think of them like customers, like a happy customer is a repeat customer. You know, if they're more than satisfied with what you did, they'll be back.
Yeah. Then, and like I said, and if I've worked with some artists who have, well, I say that it wasn't a good working relationship. And once again, not only did the comic book not really get finished with that person, but I never asked them back. I never asked to work on anything else. That's money that they lost per page, you know? But just to go back to Greenland just a little bit, a few more questions. Is the one story that you're working on with Ron Mars, with Kyle Rayner, is that could be in continuity, or is it kind of like an offshoot of from the time period of when he appeared in the past?
Oh no, it's modern continuity. So he's got his modern costume, with the symbol that's different than how I drew it, when we were working on it before. So it takes place in modern day.
Good, because it felt like for a little while that Kyle Rayner was being forgotten by DC. Obviously, to prop up Hal Jordan a little bit more, I think the last time I really remembered a lot of Kyle Rayner was when he showed up as a side character in Omega Men, that series. I can't remember who wrote that series. I think it was someone known. I don't know who it was. But so it's good to see him back in continuity because he deserves his own title.
Well, I thought, and this was, once again, I take no, I never take it for granted when I see people enjoying my artwork and paying it respect. But I remember seeing on DC's website, on their Twitter page, promoting the 80-page giant, they had used a panel that I had drawn as the preview image. Now, keep in mind, we've got, Ivan Reese, we've got Mike Grell, we've got really heavy hitters on this book, and they chose mine. I thought, wow. Of course, it was a really, it was a really dynamic shot of Kyle flying. It's kind of like, I think that was kind of a selling point, like, hey, hey fans, what do you think about Kyle now? Like, maybe they're testing the waters. Should we give Kyle his own book again, etc.? So I hope the answer is yes. And if they're looking for an artist, they know a certain guy in Columbus, Ohio.
well, I would say don't sell yourself short. I mean, when it comes to Green Lantern, you're up there with Rise and Grell and Adams, because like I said, that was you did one of the most seminal runs of Green Lantern ever.
It's in my mind, I guess I don't think that I have, because I just don't think of myself in that way. But, I hope that's true.
well, just to let you know, I have said it, so we're going to make it true. Okay. To be a legend is for someone to call you that, and you are. So when it comes to especially Green Lantern.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome. So my last two questions are, so why do you think the concept of Green Lantern lasted this long? I mean, you can say Kyle Rayner specifically, which is, you can answer that as well, but also the bigger picture, the idea of Green Lantern lasted this long, 80 years.
Flexibility. You can tell any kind of story with a Green Lantern. I mean, you can keep it as close to as a story in a neighborhood or on a far off alien planet. To me, Green Lantern is imagination itself. I mean, the nature of the power, that's why it's called the most powerful weapon in the universe, because it deals with the human imagination,
yeah,
of which there's no limit. So I think, people can imagine. You don't even have to be in shape. I mean, you could just, the ring could make you a suit with muscles and everything.
right.
Take it from there. I think people often wonder, if I had a Green Lantern ring, what would I make with it?
Yeah.
It's almost like it could be, they could be thinking like art, or they could think of weapons, or it's wide open. And I think that's part of the appeal of it. But then it's not so wide open that it has no structure. You've got the core, you've got Oa and things of that nature. So you've got a framework to work with. And so I think that's really a part of the appeal of the franchise.
So more specifically, why do you think Kyle Rayner survived well longer than you might have originally thought?
Probably because, I felt that he was a fleshed out character that, I get this all the time. I'm at shows. Kyle Rayner was the first comic I ever read, or, Kyle Rayner was my introduction to the Green Lantern mythos, that sort of thing. And so he's in a lot of people's, especially young people's foundations of who the character is. For example, older fans, maybe Alan Scott was their Green Lantern.
Yeah.
Or you know, maybe fans more closer to my age, Hal Jordan was. But for, you know, for the younger fans, you know, unless they were watching the Justice League Unlimited, you know, John Stewart was their Green Lantern, or in comics, it was Kyle. So I think, as you know, comic characters can really get deep rooted in your personal psyche. At least they are with me. So I think being a character that people really resonated with, that's gonna be there. You know,
and I'll say once again, so I in that middle ground, I started with Hal Jordan as my Green Lantern, but Kyle Rayner became my Green Lantern, and I think it really became Kyle Rayner made Green Lantern fun. You want to be Kyle Rayner. You want to enjoy it. Hal Jordan, I think before, for the last, you know, those, some of those issues leading up to it, I don't think it helped that they did age him up. I don't think, you know, maybe that made him, because I was a teenager, maybe made him feel too much like, you know, a parent instead of, you know, you. And I thought also a little bit that he also seemed just not happy as a Green Lantern. You know, like he quit a lot. He complained a lot about it. And I felt like Rayner made being a Green Lantern a fun adventure again.
I think with Hal, there were so many different high level creativity that it was hard to pinpoint exactly who he was. I mean, we had general ideas. Ron had put it like this: Hal Jordan is the hero you wish you were. Kyle Rayner is the hero that you know you feel like you could become.
Okay, I see that.
Like, for example, Hal Jordan was, I mean, he's, before he had powers, he was a test pilot, so he was like a Chuck Yeager, a heroic character from day one, whereas Kyle, not so much. He was just getting some air, walking out of the back of a nightclub, and gets handed the ring from an alien who promptly disappeared. It's like, what am I supposed to do with this? You know?
Yeah. but it worked very well with them. So my other question is right now. It's a couple of parts. One, what are you working on now? And also, how can, like, do you have a store somewhere where fans can also support you?
Well, I don't have an online store, but I have, you know, I'm on about all the social media. As far as right now, you know, like I mentioned before, I'm also a commercial illustrator, a concept art designer. Comic-wise, you know, I may have mentioned briefly earlier, Ron and I did a World War II graphic novel called Harkins Raiders, which was a Kickstarter, which also, since the Kickstarter was successful, I had my first art book to accompany it. So, you know, fans of my single images, they might want to pick up that book, which is also still available on Ominous Press's website.
Okay.
And so until the COVID demons have been exercised, you know, I'll resume doing conventions again at some point. But at the end of this month, on the 27th, I'll be at World's Greatest Comics in Westerville, Ohio, doing a book signing.
Very cool. So there's no place where you can buy autographs from you or whatnot, or get something autographed? Currently,
I'll be signing at the store, but as far as the shows, that sort of thing, I'm not really sure when that's going to fully resume. But of course, you know, you can commission me, because I do mail order commissions all year round. So now, you contact me on my social media.
Well, hopefully you come by for at a local convention at some point in the future, because like I have so many Green Lanterns for you to sign right now.
That'd be great.
So definitely please come by. So we spoke for about an hour and a half. I really do appreciate you talking with me. It was really great to talk to you. The co-creator of my favorite all-time character. This is a very special moment for me, so I really do appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate it too. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you so much. You are awesome.
And we're back.
And we're back.
What do you think?
Well, it makes me want to go and read the Kyle Rayner stuff.
Dude, I love that. You should. The Kyle Rayner stuff is good.
I didn't even know who he was until you said it, because I wasn't.
Really?
Yeah, I wasn't really reading comic books then. And you don't ever see Kyle Rayner when it's. The only two you see when you watch anything animated by DC is Jon Stewart and Hal Jordan. That's it.
Yeah.
You don't see anybody else.
Very true. They should do Kyle Rayner, because Kyle Rayner is cool, because he's an artist and he has some very creative constructs, which is cool.
That is cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
So I just don't know him as
Well, you should go read some. The original run is pretty
cool.
Well,
why don't you pull some out? You not put them out of your collection, but just like write down which ones I should read and I'll check them out.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, there's actually I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but there is a trade paperback that came out like in 2004 or 2005 or something like that based on with Kyle Rayner. And it's a phenomenal read. I'll find, that's the one you should read. But I'll find the name of it and give it to you.
Okay. Cool. Perfect. But yeah. Where did you guys go? I hope you really, really enjoyed that. Daryl Banks, it was a lot of fun. You could tell Jeff had a lot of fun. And hopefully, as things progress, maybe he'll come back on and share some other things that he has going on in his life. If you did enjoy that, I implore you to go to spoilerverse.com, check out all of our back issues, and of course, not only for Spoiler Country, but for all the other podcasts that are hosted there, like video game podcasts, other geek culture podcasts, music podcasts. They're all right there for you to peruse and enjoy.
And if you're looking for something a little different than the geek culture stuff there, check out Waiting on a Miracle by Sal from, he's from Nerds from the Crypt. It's about him and his wife basically on their struggles of trying to conceive with not being able to conceive and going through fertility treatment. So it's actually a really fun dive into, you know, someone's life. So check that out. It's a lot of fun.
There you guys go. Johnny, there's only like one more thing to do.
Yeah, what's that?
And in Oceans of Podcasts, we are Cthulhu. And as Cthulhu compels you to do, open the mind and read more.